Welcome to the Victims and Villains Podcast. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I'm your host, Captain Nostalgia, and things are about to get super fiery because on this episode we are talking about Dark Phoenix, the comics, and the brand new movie, which is actually going to be the last X-Men Fox movie in existence. But before we get over to that, we are starting with Manhattan's Media Moments. We're talking about the original comic saga from Chris Claremont all the way from 1970s. But please help me in welcoming from Living Fire Gaming, Mr. Andrew Simpson. What's going on, man?
Hey, not a whole lot. How about yourself?
I'm good, man. I'm really good. I'm enjoying my cup of tea, and I'm getting to revisit one of my favorite arcs in the X-Men comics. So this is actually your first time reading this. What were your thoughts kind of coming out of this?
Okay, so I'm not huge. Like, I like the X-Men, but I wasn't huge on them. So I knew about this storyline. And I was like, it's like the big one for the X-Men. So I was really excited when you actually messaged me like, hey, so you got Marvel Unlimited, so you could like read literally almost anything. So when you offered me to do the Dark Phoenix, I'm like, okay, this is my opportunity to branch out beyond Spider-Man, which I'm a huge fan of. And I was excited to read it. And I got to say, coming out of it, I really liked it. And I have... it's on my to-read list, but I'm going to go back and read the original Phoenix Saga as well. So thank you for that, actually. It was really good. I loved it.
no problem, man. I feel like now, as in it, like, because I read this when I was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. It was the first time that I had read this in the comics. And I really love this in the comic format, but I felt like this time revisiting it in anticipation for Dark Phoenix that I had a finer appreciation for it. The way that the way that the storytelling builds, the way that you have one villain that slowly fades into another villain, and it's just Chris Claremont has a way of just creating these really masterful moments of just storytelling and world building, but also mythos building. And there's a reason that he is so synonymous with the X-Men franchise, and he's well deserved. If I could recommend, literally, if you pick up anything else, I would definitely recommend picking up the anything Claremont has written. Claremont has written some of the best X-Men stories, if not the best, in the history of the mythos.
I now agree with you on that. I think one of my favorite moments from it was the, I don't know if we're talking spoilers naturally, right? I mean,
it's kind of. At this point, it's kind of been out for 30 years, but we're going to give out a light spoiler warning. So if you guys haven't read the comics yet, just light spoilers as we kind of talk very mildly about the comic arc.
Okay. My favorite moment was the psychic sword fight between Cyclops and Mastermind. Simply just trying to get to, with Scott loving Jean as much as he did. That's so valiant of him. And I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And even though he lost, I think ultimately it kind of worked out in the end. I mean, Phoenix went crazy on Mastermind's like, oh, you want power here? I'm going to give you the power of, like, the cosmos, pretty much. And, like, he just expands his mind until he's just dead. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. What a payoff.
Well, I think, too, that just the buildup of the very subtle buildup in the opening issue for this arc with the connection to Mastermind, who is Jason Winnegard, if I'm pronouncing his name right.
Yeah.
He's got this connection to this group of mutants that are like this like inner circle within this larger group called the Hellfire Club, which honestly, kind of coming out of this, I got about halfway through this arc and I was like, dang, I was like, I really wish that Hellfire and, like, you know, Sebastian Stan, like, or Shaw, that they had more of a presence in some of these cinematic movies, because they are just as good of villains, if not a little bit better than the Brotherhood of Mutants. And I'm probably gonna catch a lot of flack for that, but I'm just kind of Magneto'd out at this point.
Yeah. I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that, I read this, like, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago now, when you recommended it to me, so I've been reading a lot of other comics since, but if I remember correctly, Magneto doesn't really show up in this comic a lot, and I did kind of like that, like, I'm not seeing him, because I've always associated, Magneto's, like, the arch-villain of the X-Men, so seeing someone different in that role was really cool. I agree with you on that point. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, so, like, they really, Claremont really has this way to masterfully build up not only the presence of the Phoenix and the Black Queen, but also the interpretations of just the buildup and the villainy of the Hellfire Club and this inner circle of mutants. And I think that it makes them really formidable foes. And we got Shaw in First Class on the big screen. He was played by Kevin Bacon back in 2011. And he was one of the best parts of that movie. But also this arc, also it's worth noting that this arc also gave us Kitty Pryde, who was such a cool part of this arc in the two issues that she's in. She kind of basically becomes this like X-Men without really being ignited, kind of one of those Spider-Man Infinity War moments where it's just like you're now a X-Men.
Yeah. I thought she was an interesting character. Yeah, I remember the only thing I remember about Kitty Pryde up before this, and this is vaguely, I had to go and watch some, like, who is Kitty Pryde again? When I was in between readings, and I remembered, oh yeah, she was in the third X-Men movie for like a few scenes with Juggernaut, and I'm like, oh, so seeing who she actually was in the comics was really cool to see too. So.
But so kind of after the defeat of the Hellfire Club, we get this like full out cosmic battle. And before we bring in the cosmic element of the Dark Phoenix saga, I think it's also worth mentioning is that Claremont has this entire issue where Wolverine completely, almost single-handedly takes down and rescues the X-Men and takes down the Hellfire Club, which was just one of the coolest, just has some of the coolest fight sequences in the entire arc.
I do find it funny. I've been meaning to post this because I took screenshots of this moment when Shaw is fighting Storm. I found it hilarious that like the only reason she didn't quite get away from him was because of her cake. Or cape, sorry, not cake. I'm just like, Edna Mode, this is the reason why we don't wear capes. Storm didn't have the cape, she would have got away, but nope. Shaw's like, let me just slam you here, there. Get out of here. It was, I thought that was a funny moment too, but yeah, that really was a fun little sequence of Wolverine and that rescuing them and then them all getting out of the Hellfire Club. Gosh, that whole first half was good.
Yeah, I love this sequence where he just, like, they're getting ready to really blade into the X-Men, and he just bursts through with all of these goons, and he says something really quippy, like, hate to interrupt, or something like that, but he just kind of comes in and just makes his presence known, and it is one of the best sequences in all of the arc of this one, and then we get to really explore a lot of the Dark Phoenix in space, because then she kind of goes and goes world-eating, basically.
Yeah.
She got a hunger on her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Literally, I remember when we were messaging about it a few days ago, it's basically the Death Star. She blew up a planet. She killed a whole race of people just by consuming this star, and then everything just kind of, they're dead now.
Yeah, which is funny because there's this moment within it, and I think that one of the things that I've been really underwhelmed with the cinematic interpretation that we got in X-Men 3 and kind of my cautious optimism for Dark Phoenix, the Dark Phoenix with Sophie Turner, is that you never really get to see how powerful Phoenix is. And to your point of, you know, comparing it to the Death Star, Lyandra, who is the Empress of this of the Shi'ar Empire, I mispronounced that. Super sorry, but she says this. She says even Galactus may compare to insignificance to her two feeding and in his infernal hunger he consumes world. Feed hers, Phoenix may consume all that exists. So to say that she has a greater hunger than the consumer of worlds and Galactus, that is quite saying something about her hunger. And kind of seeing because the issue post it's the kind of this transition in the arc where you have the defeat of the Hellfire Club, but this like really all out like space war between the you know the Kree, the Skrull, and like all these empires coming together to take down the X-Men, or for lack of a better term, to basically take down and destroy the Phoenix once and for all. It is that kind of exploring her into space, and her father even there's a point where she goes back home and her father casts her out and he's like, look, I don't know you, I don't know who you've become, like this is not my daughter.
And then the fight, then when they fought the I got into that part and I didn't know like half of the cosmic stuff, but as far as Galactus, yeah, the comparison to Galactus, the fact that Phoenix is more powerful than that really kind of blew me away. And me being a gamer, so I have Galactus is both Galactus and Phoenix are actually in Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. And the fact that Phoenix wasn't even like the, you know, she's this weak character in that game. I'm not even kidding. And it's part of her play style is the fact that her one of her level 3 supers is the Dark Phoenix. So the way that works is you build it up to you build your like super hypermeter or whatever to the maximum, and then when Jean dies, she becomes the Dark Phoenix, and her health is constantly regenerating. And just like how the fact in the comics that they acknowledge that she's more powerful than Galactus, I'm like, that's interesting. I didn't know that, but no,
she has a hunger that is greater than Galactus.
That's
for,
it. Yeah.
For the consumption of worlds. But just you look at some of the names, you know, Gladiator calls her the Black Angel of Legend, the Chaos Bringer, the Ravager of Worlds, Cyclops. She's continuously throughout the comics, but Cyclops pointed out that she is power incarnate. There is no force in existence that can stand against her. There's also a sequence where Storm is sensing the Phoenix, and she says basically the senses pan that she feels sadness and an all-consuming lust, and you just kind of look and you see this empty, just powerful, empty void of a character. And I think that what I like about this is that this opened up the X-Men mythos so wide for the Jean Grey character that in some respects the Phoenix as an entity has kind of gone on in the X-Men mythos to kind of be almost the seventh Infinity Stone, if you will, to where they've had arcs where Cyclops has had the Phoenix power, and that was insane.
I actually read that was the Avengers versus X-Men storyline, which I think I read right after Phoenix, and that was, oh my gosh, seeing Emma Frost and all these other guys, like, oh, instead of I think it's Hope Summers was supposed to get it, it's like their daughter, that we got Colossus has it, Emma Frost, Scott, and two others that I forgot for some reason. But yeah, the fact Phoenix is really just another kind of big cosmic entity in the Marvel universe, and oh my gosh, it was insane seeing that.
There's also another arc where you have I can't remember there's like these like mutant triplets, and like they each inherit like a portion of the entity, and it's just, it's incredible to kind of watch these.
Yeah.
Watch how this entity interacts with all these mutants, taking an already powerful being that is above, as they call it in the movies, the level above Homo sapiens, to, you know, almost elevate it to the point of, as the Dark Phoenix calls it, you know, almost to God level.
Yeah. That was... Oh. I didn't know much about the Phoenix going into it. I just knew, like, oh, okay, she has mind powers. But yeah, Phoenix, very powerful character indeed. That's about all I knew about Jean Grey, because like I said, I wasn't too big on X-Men. I respected that they were there, and I thought Wolverine was one of my favorites, along with Cyclops, until after reading Avengers vs. X-Men, Cyclops is kind of a jerk. But, I mean, come on. Like, I'm watching him in that arc, and he's just, like, paranoid as all get out, trying to keep his daughter from, like, inheriting the Phoenix. Like, no, like, or she's supposed to be the savior of mutants, yada yada. But, yeah, Phoenix is, oh my gosh. I have a whole new level of respect, and I'm looking forward to reading more of stories like, yeah, storylines like that, just involving the Phoenix.
Well, I think, too, the one thing that really helps Chris Claremont stand out as a writer in the X-Men mythos as well is that this story, while it is so action-packed in the storytelling, it's also heartbreaking at the same time, because you mm-hmm. have a lot of these, there's a couple of issues and there's a lot of sequences within this where the team really holds back from kind of punching or like actually like, like, you know, getting physical with this being, because that this is their ally. This is someone that they have been in the field with for years. To Storm even compares her to a sister at one point. You know, Jean Grey is loved by Colossus says it very few times about how much he loves her. Obviously, Wolverine loves her. The sequences in the end with Cyclops and Jean Grey, it's these very heartbreaking situations. So you have this very great action thriller, well-built story, but it also has this very heartbreaking undertone at the same time.
Yeah, because Jean had to sacrifice herself and to save her friends, and she did that. And the Watcher said something, if I remember correctly, like Jean could have went on to become like a god. And as we discussed, but she chose to die a human because she loves her friends and family that much that she's like, no, I don't want this. So fine, Scott, if you won't really help me out by, you know, killing me necessarily, now I want to save you. Something like that. Like, but it is very heartbreaking. I kind of like, I was like, whoa. And then Scott just kind of like, nah, I'm kind of done with this. I thought, absolutely, oh
yeah.
I was like, I didn't even know he quit, but I guess he did at one point. Again, I'm still learning all this cool stuff about the X-Men, so I gotta thank you a lot for having me read this. It's opened me up to the X-Men.
No problem. But all right, man. So we're getting ready to fade into our Dark Phoenix review with the Long Coat Mafia podcast. But if you had to give this a score on our Rorschach rating scale, 1 to 5, what would you give Dark Phoenix?
As the story arc goes, it's up there. I'd probably, I don't want to say 5 because that's just like, whoa, like, oh my gosh. And it was a good storyline, but I'm still reading a lot of the comics. Since I never really read Marvel as a kid, I didn't get into Marvel until actually, ironically, the original X-Men movies. And I was kind of into that, and then I went on to Spider-Man, and then everything kind of just blew up from there. But I give it a 4, a solid 4. It's good. It's up there for me, and I love it.
I think I'm also going to give this a 4. I would say that this is a really solidly written story. It's a reason that, you know, we're talking about it almost 40 years after it's been made. It's been made into a movie twice. It's been done in the cartoon several times. The Phoenix has been brought into comics, modern day comics, several different times in several different ways. It is one of the most beloved Marvel properties and Marvel story arcs for a reason. I think that it does have some plot problems, some plot holes that I could have kind of done without, or sequences that I felt like kind of didn't add to the larger narrative, whether that was emotionally or, you know, just to the larger, you know, this very action-packed art. But still, it's a good read. Highly absolutely recommend it. If you've never read it, 4 out of 5 for both of us here. But as we transition and take a commercial break, where can people find more about Living Fire Gaming?
You can find us on YouTube. We're at www.youtube.com/livingfiregaming. We stream every now Tuesday and Thursday. Thursday is our multiplayer gaming podcast, or not podcast, sorry. Our multiplayer gaming show versus Thursday, where we'll play multiplayer games online. And if you want, we have all of our info in the description of our videos on how to add us on your respective console. And every Tuesday is just kind of something like, if I feel like playing a game, we'll play it. In fact, I think as of this recording, this coming Tuesday, I'm going to try Cuphead. I've beaten it already, and I'm going to try going through it now on Expert. And everyone's going to watch me torture myself. So you can come find us there. That's where we're at.
All right. Well, like a phoenix, we are going to fly over to the Alamo Theater, where we are recording live for our Dark Phoenix review. But more importantly, if you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please, please, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 129 suicides that take place each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death every 40 seconds. So please stay with us. Please, if you or someone you know is struggling, reach out. Every day there's joy in the world simply because you're in it. And there is hope. There are resources. You guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. You guys can call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You can also text anonymously to 741-741 or go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can get even more resources past just those. And all of those resources are going to be in the show notes for this, along with all of Andrew's contact information. Andrew, thank you so much for taking time, reading, and talking Dark Phoenix.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the recommendation. I loved it.
No problem. Well, please stay with us, and we'll be right back after this commercial break. Welcome back to Victims and Villains. We're moving from comics to film, because we are live at the Alamo in Winchester, Virginia, to talk about the brand new X-Men film, the final X-Men film from Fox. I'm joined by Mr. Chris the Godfather Lumser. What's up, man?
Hello, everyone.
Let's jump into it, man. Yeah. No spoilers. What are your general thoughts kind of coming out of it?
It was better than X-Men 3. Though that was out way better. Well,
2006.
So more than a decade ago, better than I expected. Or I didn't go into any external reviews in regards to this, because when I see a geek film, I try to stay away from any external reviews so I could go in unaltered and I don't have any bias than what I go into. So like I said, it was way better than 3. It had a lot of similarities to what I remember from watching the cartoon, which is, again, even further back than 2006.
1980. The comics is 1980. Cartoons
was
like
mid-90s, mid to late 90s. So that was mostly my experience with the Dark Phoenix saga. And for, I think, a lot of folks that were like myself that kind of collected comics in the 80s, we had our baseline. A lot of kids my age, our baseline for a lot of DC and Marvel lore were the animated series. Granted, they weren't comic exact, but for a baseline, they were perfect. So I want to say it's way better than that, because I watched Apocalypse a few days ago in regards to at least getting
prepared
a little bit. And when you look at X-Men Apocalypse and...
Ouch.
In regards to special effects, meaning there were parts in the movie when you look at it that was designed to pause it on screen, take a screen capture, and use it as a desktop. That's at parts for that. This didn't have that.
See, I have my own quarrels with that like section that we'll get to when we get to the spoilers. But I'm also gonna say that this is, I've been trying also to kind of keep away from like reviews, and it's hard because the reviews for this film hit like Tuesday,
right?
And critics are talking about how bad this movie is. It's entertaining, but I will also say that I can understand where they're coming from.
Right.
It's a misguided tale, especially coming out of the source material at the beginning of this episode to prepare for it. Thank you once again to Andrew. But also at the same time, I think that it's entertaining, but I also have my quarrels with it coming out of it. Fresh into my mind, it's entertaining film, still have quarrels with it. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to go ahead and jump into the spoilers. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick commercial break and jump into spoilers right after this message. But once again, if you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 129 suicides that take place each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death every 40 seconds. So please, if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. Call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You can text anonymously to 741-741. Or go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can get even more resources past those ones that I've just mentioned. And again, all of those resources are going to be in the show notes for wherever you guys are listening to this episode of Victims and Villains or any of our content at all. So please, like the Phoenix, we're going to rise, and we're going to be right back after this commercial break. Welcome back to Victims and Villains. We are still live at the Alamo here in Winchester, Virginia, and we're jumping into the spoilers territory of Dark Phoenix. So if you guys have not seen it yet, please, please, please run to your local theaters and go check it out and then come back and hit play. But I'm going to start this off because this is the final... Spoiler warning is now in effect, by the way.
Yeah, Superman dies.
Man, no. So this is the final X-Men film that we're getting from Fox before it enters into the MCU. How do you think that this fares as a final goodbye for a franchise that's been breathing for 19 years?
It, on that aspect, it seemed almost like a... I don't want to really say a slap in the face, because it didn't have... When you look at a lot of the... Over the past 19 years, in the Fox section of the Marvel Universe, you had the standard, almost copycat flicker of comics and everything else. I didn't notice that. I might have been trying to write down my menu order, but I didn't know. It just had the standard, okay, Fox intro logos, and that was it, and it just got into it. And it was like, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. It's like, wait a minute. It's supposed to be an X-Men movie. It's supposed to be a Marvel, not, I won't say an MCU movie, but it's still considered a Marvel movie. And it didn't have the standard flicker. One of the other things I was expecting to kind of see at the start, or even though we didn't really stay after credits, but something that saying thank you, Stan, I didn't even see that. And that's one of the things, even with the, even though you didn't really see it in Avengers Endgame, but I think they even had like a thank you Stan somewhere in there. Especially in Captain Marvel, you had a thank you Stan Lee for everything you did. But this didn't have anything, even though if it didn't have it in Endgame, I can understand it because it was in Captain Marvel. They did it that way. This, they could have at least on the Fox end said, thank you, Stan. Even though you had a executive producer credit, it should have been there.
I mean, this film, I think that the what we got with Endgame and Stan Lee, like that kind of, that really kind of is better Like, it's peaceful the way they ended it right. that way. I think that Chris Claremont, of all people, or John Braun, who are the reasons that the Phoenix is even a entity in the Marvel Comics universe, I think that they should have gotten a little bit more credit with this one. But, I mean, as a final farewell for a Fox film, this film is a serious letdown in that regard. I kind of walked into this expecting basically no X-Men to make it out alive. I expected more deaths past just Mystique and Raven, honestly.
I only heard that there was going to... That's one of the things I heard. It was going to be like, yeah, you're never going to believe who dies in Dark Phoenix. Technically, two people died, but we know about Raven. We now know Raven died in the hands of Phoenix, or the Dark Phoenix. And as for a lot of folks out there who know the comic, there's no Kree in this at all.
Well, the Kree and the Skrull like really didn't have like a huge part in the comics. They had like a little bit towards like the last couple issues of the saga, but it was the majority of the villain in this in the comics was actually the Hellfire Club.
Yeah, right.
Which I'm kind of let down that wasn't in this one. But Jessica Chastain plays the villain in this, and she is of the Baudari
Something
Empire.
Like that. But to me, it kind of, even though they had that reference to it, but it seemed like that they were heavily referencing, because the if you want to call her the leader, the way her hair is, and you know it being long white and being almost the... one of the main people.
It's really stretching.
Yeah, I'm stretching here, but you could... How they kind of made it, it was like hinting at a Hellfire Club reference and a Emma Frost touching on it.
Because I'm pretty sure from what I read, like, the Jessica Chastain character was supposed to be... There's similar race in the Marvel comics close to the... Skrull, where she can shapeshift into it, because when we first introduced her, like, they're like, ha ha ha, dinner party kind of thing, and you get to kind of just kind of see this with the dog, and she goes out there in this very brief looking she returns to the dinner party and kills everyone. It's like they never really build up the villain at all and go anywhere with her. They just kind of show up, and they have, like, maybe one or two throwaway lines that kind of explain, quote, motive. And then that's just kind of it. Like, it almost kind of seems like background noise in the overall plot of the film.
I'm going to say you're right in regards to that, but I want to point out one thing. We're going to jump ahead a little bit. Is that we could always jump back. But did you notice the patches on those... on the guards in the train?
MCU.
Yeah, MCU. I was like, I normally have my phone on severe dim, typing up notes. I know you have a pen and paper, but I was like, well, this one's like, the guards had, my notes was like, that's in essence the last half of the film is when I was taking notes. And Patches said, damn you, autocorrect, because it says Patches say McIntyre. No, they said, MCU.
I think that's supposed to mean like our mutant containment unit.
Right. But I think when initially this movie was being made, the merger wasn't in effect. And therefore, this could have been kind of almost a slap in Disney MCU's face, saying Marvel, in essence, Disney and Marvel is the bad guy. We're Fox. Then all of a sudden, Disney merged with Fox and bought Fox. So, and they didn't really have time to edit that out.
There's going to be so much memes that come out of this movie.
Oh, that if not already, if not, the fact, I don't know what you have written down, in regards to where you started with your notes. So we'll go from there. I know I jumped ahead a little bit.
No, you're good. And I knew one of us was going to bring that patch scene up.
I know for a fact, from what I heard on my end, that the ending was changed. It was more Captain Marvel-esque in regards to the ending from what I heard. I don't know how accurate that was, but that's what I heard.
It seems more anticlimactic, which is another reason I think that as a final farewell to the X-Men and Fox, like, it just seems like kind of anticlimactic and kind of falls. Like, it's still an entertaining film, but when you're talking about, you know, putting a bow on all of these films, it definitely falls flat. You look at Logan, how that ended,
right?
His entire arc for 17 years, you still think about it today, and I don't know about you, but I still, like, get really teary-eyed thinking about that, those final couple scenes. Oh,
the ninjas cutting onions coming to your house?
Just a little bit. And then you look at Endgame and look at just how perfect of a ending and culmination that was. And that's what I feel like it should have been, but I feel like Dark Phoenix is an unfortunate kind of Dark Phoenix is ultimately a product of the Disney merger, because I think it ultimately got hurt by that financially, and just the way that the film flows a little bit.
I think that you're right on that. You have a valid point on that, because it does seem a little bit like that, because if there were rewrites and reshoots in this, there were a lot of similarities to 3. A little bit. Little in regards to, they didn't, it's like they were trying to do 3, but better. A tad. Like,
which is ironic, because the gentleman that wrote this film also wrote the third one.
Maybe that's why.
Simon Kinberg. So let's jump into this one. Simon Kinberg, it was for a while. So after Apocalypse, they set this up. They set this film up, which, let's jump into that. And another thing that I kind of really took me off guard about this film is that Apocalypse set up Jean with the Phoenix Saga, Phoenix already.
Right.
By the end, that is how Apocalypse is defeated, by the Phoenix Force.
Right. That's what kind of got me as well. It's like, they set her up as Phoenix, and she gets the Phoenix in this. I'm like, oh, that's a little...
But it takes place 10 years after she's already had it. So that's why I'm like, what is this?
Right. And as well as, you know, with it going that in mind, we both know, seeing Apocalypse, that Storm is, and Magneto are graciously overpowered, or were overpowered by Apocalypse. Therefore, with that being said, if Magneto was a level 10 mutant, or the highest level mutant on the planet, he should have been able to at least done something in regards to being on par with Jean Grey at this point.
Keep in mind that there is that scene where they're at Magneto's, like, little island.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute, is that a Genosha reference? You know, in a way, you could say it's like, if the movies were still going, that could have been a great Genova reference right there. Because they didn't really refer to it as Genosha. The fans could say, oh, yeah, that they're referring to Genosha in that. But another thing is, like, that I could say that they did, because we kind of did spoil it, Raven does, or Mystique does, die in this.
Well, Disney set themselves up for failures, because they put that in the second trailer.
I don't watch a lot of the trailers.
I don't either, but I had friends that ruined it for me. They're like, oh, this totally shows the death of Mystique. And it's like, well, you just set yourself up for failure. You look at how BVS did it with showing Doomsday in the second trailer that one.
Or how they showed John Connor getting shot and being in in essence, majority of the movie in the trailer for
Genesis.
But with that, it's like, everybody kind of knows that Mystique has her own healing factor as well. So it's like, that's a little bit of a disappointment. You underpowered another strong mutant in a way.
Well, I mean, at this one, after Apocalypse, I think one of the most common complaints about Apocalypse was how Jennifer Lawrence, who plays Mystique, kind of phones it in. Like, her performance is just kind of flat throughout the duration of the film. And my wife and I, like, we had, like, long conversations about her specific performance, because you look at performances like Hunger Games or Silver Lining Playbook and or Joy or Mother, and you see how good of an actress she can really be when she believes in the project. And then you kind of get into some of these X-Men films, and it seems like everything past Days of Future Past with her, her character has just kind of been this, like, really dull, really flat, really monotone, just uninvested character.
Do you think that's why she was only in the movie for maybe, what, a half an hour, hour?
Well, that's the thing, is, like, I don't even know why they really had to give her, like, kind of the screen time, because they made her a leader in this one, which is such a weird thing, because the first class movies are supposed to basically say, okay, we're telling the stories of the teams that you know from the 2000s movie with Pat. Mystique was consistently on the Brotherhood of Mutants with Magneto and him. One, you just kind of have her up and down as a good guy, which kind of, to me, just didn't make sense. And I don't know enough about the Raven that we know from the First Day films or First Class films or this Echo Remain
plan for Lawrence, but the character herself was more so a rogue. I don't mean the character or X-Men rogue. I'm talking about the overall personalities. Even though she's a character or a bad person, she'll be good if she needs to be good. Or email the person that was mostly on an element other than Logan was Magneto. Magneto would be there would be a time that Magneto was the bad guy. Then he'd be on the X-Men for a little while. Then he'd be the bad guy again. So he was the character that was always on and off with the X-Men, not Mystique. I think with the movies, they were trying to reverse that a little bit, trying to keep Magneto who he is in regards to that he was a friend of Xavier, but still the bad guy, the polar opposite of what Xavier stands for. Yet to be on the other on again, off again of the X-Men, Mystique was supposed to be that, aka Raven. But I don't think the writers really tried to do that. And another thing, did you notice that the uniforms that the X-Men were wearing were the new X-Men's?
I knew that, like, because it was taking place
in
the 90s.
It was the new X-Men. They were I think it was when it was Grant Morrison. I got an internet connection here. I'm going to see if I can pull it up through Google. It was the new when the first films came out. The reason why they were leather was to mimic the new X-Men comics that were out at that time. And let's see if it comes up on Google. New X. Go. And let's see. No, it's coming up. New Mutants. Oh, yeah, here it is. This is the 2001 series, New X-Men.
Oh. I always thought that they went to give the suits to kind of mimic the 90s and, like, the colors of how they looked, kind of with the neons of that decade. But I feel like we've spent a lot of time talking about what makes this film not the greatest. And this film, after Apocalypse was released, Bryan Singer, who had directed this one, he had stepped down to focus on Bohemian Rhapsody. And you can also check out our Bohemian Rhapsody review with this one as well. Talk about Bryan Singer, but this film didn't have a director for a while, so Simon Kinberg actually made his directorial debut with this. And I gotta say, from someone that really had really loves directors in this medium, I think he did a really good job. This is a visually, for the most part, is a visually stunning film.
I can almost say that for a new type of director, doing a superhero film can be tough, because especially if you don't know the source material or the genre in general. I don't know if he does or not. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
He has been a part of the X-Men franchise, I want to say, since the early days. Okay. Like I said, he had originally been the writer of Last Stand, and he might have even been a writer for one of the first two films. But he's been producing this franchise forever. He's been deeply involved in Fox's interpretation of these Marvel characters.
Now, I will say this, because even though you said that we've been trying to talk about the negatives, but I want to say this. A pissed off Kurt Nightcrawler, oh, that was badass. Him just, I want to say that. It's like, let me just focus on a pissed off Kurt for a little while, because that's a character that you don't really, that I don't really remember ever seeing pissed. That level of, I'm going to kick your ass. And that's what he pretty much does. He takes it up a notch. It was just a fun, cool thing to see. At least on him, just going full out and just doing what, in some instances, what Nightcrawler does best, is using his teleportation as a fighting, along with a fighting technique, more than you saw in Apocalypse. Because he just used it, poof, 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 and that was it. This was poof, strike, strike, just all over. This was a more educated Kurt. Mm-hmm. So it was just fun to see, and just him taking it up to an nth level.
Well, I feel like when you meet him in Apocalypse, you don't really see how he becomes Alan Cumming's version in X2, and it's been a couple years since I've seen X2, but with this one, I feel like you kind of get to see how he becomes his character in X2, like where he ultimately ends up. Like, to me, I feel like out of all the characters that are in this film, he definitely feels the most well-rounded as a mirror image of how we come to know him in X2, in the church, in the beginning. And though I will say, while it was cool to see, it kind of was a strange narrative choice to make, because he just snaps after a guy that he's met for like 20 minutes dies and kills, and he's like, oh, I'm just gonna go on a rampage. Like, that just kind of what broke him. Like, I don't know, it to me, like, it was a weird choice for motive to kind of set him off that way. It was awesome to see. It's a visually stunning sequence, and props to Simon Kinberg for pulling that off, because it looks awesome. And like you said, like, it's a very well educated Kurt that has been with the X-Men for 10 years now. He knows how to really use and hone in on his powers and his strengths, and that's what I really loved about seeing his arc throughout the course of this. But also at the same time, I don't know, it's just what sets it off kind of took me out of that moment a little bit. But once you kind of like gel into it, it's cool, really stunning to see.
I will admit that aspect of, you know, in the scene, is that the guard just walks down by Kurt and looks at him briefly and goes, "My son was a fan." And you're right, it was an odd twist to, like, in a way that he wants to prove that he's still the hero that he was, but it was just an odd way for them to go that route, that he wanted to save this. There were, overall, some jumps and leaps that I think you brought up earlier that they could have explained a little bit more, and they just didn't. One of the things I did have, I don't know if you wrote it down, is that One of my biggest gripes is the whole "when bullets don't work" trope.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
It's like, when do you stop? It's like you're pulling. I can understand. There are movies that I've seen is like they have a low caliber gun, and they use it on the bad guy or the bad person, if you will, and it doesn't work. They grab a bigger gun to use that, and that I can understand. And it's like, okay, this caliber didn't work. I'm going to use a higher caliber. Maybe that will work. Okay, that didn't work. Let's bring in the tank. Okay, that didn't work. And they still ramp it up. And it's like, okay, at what point do you say, heck with this, I'm just going to go home? And it's just like, they're just putting round after round after round into the aliens and everything else. It's... and nothing's working. They just keep getting up. And it's like, you know what? Granted, we got to defend this train, this objective. But at what point do we say, you know what? Nothing's working.
Well, I think that kind of also goes, too, into the underdevelopment of these characters for the most part, especially with the villains, because these guys are supposed to be this big, bad alien race. And, yeah, we've established that nothing's going to stop them. Clearly in this mythology and the rules of this universe, that when an alien cosmic force comes in, of course ordinary guns are not going to kill them, but you know, they just, I don't know, it's just, it kind of goes back to that thing. But I want to jump back to Nightcrawler real quick.
Okay.
And I gotta say, Nightcrawler, Beast, and Raven as well, when you look at, there's a lot of CGI in this film, but the practical effects in this film look astonishing, especially the details that they were able to manage, because there's a lot of close-up shots with Beast and a lot of close-up shots with Kurt as well, the Nightcrawler, yeah. And there's the detail that they put into the special effects and the practical effects of on these actors, freaking astonishing. I think this is some of the best practical effects that this film franchise has seen since the early days of Rebecca Romijn in X-Men.
Oh, nothing could probably top her. Nothing could probably top her, but... or at least with... when was Beast in X-Men X2?
Beast was in X3, and Kelsey Grammer still looks phenomenal. His, yeah. He still holds up really well.
I was just thinking, because I know that, with Romijn, she was still Mystique in 3. Mm-hmm. So I will say, in regards to that, the makeup holds with both. I won't say Kramer's Beast looks a little bit, but in regards to this new line of X-Men movies, older, there was more to him, like, meaning he was like progressing towards the Kelsey type of Beast or version of Beast, and you saw that with Kurt where Kurt has like kind of like the lines in his face a little bit, the circles and that aspect. You kind of see that in the practical in this, like he gets that during this fight on the train. Granted, we don't see... It's just pretty much... I think it was more... I don't think Jennifer Lawrence wanted to be in full body.
Well, she was actually allergic to it when she did it in First Class. She had an allergic reaction.
In Apocalypse?
No, in First Class. When she had First Class, like, if you watch her... If you watch her effects throughout First Class, the Days of the Future Past, to Apocalypse, to now, it gets progressively more and more like skin toned, because she was actually allergic to the material they were using.
Okay, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That being said, she wouldn't be the first actress to be allergic to the body makeup that, at least that I know of in history. Folks at home. The other person that I know would be Virginia Hay, who played, I forgot the character's name in Farscape, but she mostly was in blue and kind of light blue tones on the show, and she was the reason why they kind of killed her off. It's been over 10 years. I could spoil Farscape for all of you. The reason why they kind of killed her off is not that she wanted to go, is just that she was starting to have issues with the makeup, and she was kind of tired of kind of every other week having her head kind of shaved down. So it was like, as much as I love the character, as much as I love the show, I have to step back, step away because of health. So,
yeah, for sure. And I mean, sometimes it takes an actress to do that. And I think when you're talking about actresses, obviously Game of Thrones was a huge deal this year.
Right.
I am not a fan.
I think I might have seen a half an episode somewhere.
It's just not my cup of tea. I've given it a shot. But
I know, how dare us, right?
Sophie Turner is Jean Grey in this film, and she is the... I mean, this movie makes or breaks with her. How do you think that she did with Jean Grey, her arc throughout the course of this film?
I think she portrayed the character very well, because I think Jean is supposed to be kind of how I heard many people describe the actress that plays Jean Grey as statuesque. I believe that kind of...
You're talking about Framke Jensen, the chick who played it in the original trilogy?
No, the one
Sophie
now.
Turner.
Sophie Turner. Nothing against the actress that originally played her. I'm talking now. Sophie is kind of statuesque, and she has to be like that. She showed more in this, playing Dark Phoenix. She showed a little bit more emotion and more struggle being Dark Phoenix in this than in...
In Apocalypse.
Not in Apocalypse. I'm talking in Dark Phoenix right now. She showed more emotion than the original Jean Grey character, because it didn't seem like... Even though she was emotional, but she seemed stiff in the original trilogy. That character, she seemed a little bit stiff.
It's been a long time since I've seen the original trilogy.
I'm trying to remember in regards to that, but she seemed that particular character and that how the actress. Nothing against her; she's a good actress. She's done a lot of other great roles, but Sophie seems a little bit more. Looser with the character in regards to personality, meaning that when it's time for her to be emotional, she's emotional in the role. It's like, okay, you're supposed to be sad, upset, you're supposed to cry, okay, do it. And you see the tears, you see her being, oh yeah, I'm hurting my family, I have to. And you see the tears in her eyes, you see them rolling down, whereas you didn't really see that come off Jean Grey until maybe when she was trying to kill Wolverine in X3. Like, oh, why am I trying to kill you? But I got to kill you and, you know, try to kill you in third, you know. But it was just, you know, comparing the two Jean Greys, the one that Sophie was playing seemed a little bit more looser and more well played.
I can see that, and I definitely really like Sophie's take on the character. I think that, like you said, like it's definitely a lot more looser. But I also think that,
now don't get me wrong, folks. I mean that in a good way, not a bad way. I know there's going to be a lot of people, how dare you say that, but it's a way how a lot of actresses and actors tend to portray a role. Sometimes you get, if it's the same character, you'll get one actor play it really stiff and another actor years later play it a little bit looser, and it's a better take.
It also too could be the writing could also attribute to that as well. And it's been so long since I've seen the original, but I think as her, this film really makes her break, like it really rides on Turner's shoulders. And I think that she does a really good job with it. I think that she's very emotional when she's... You can definitely tell that she's torn between this family that she now has in the X-Men, but also between this cosmic force and this cosmic hunger. We talked about this with Andrew from Living Fire Gaming when we talked about the comics. In the comics, in the original continuity, when they're talking about the Phoenix Force, Lyandra actually says that the Phoenix Force is basically has a hunger that is greater than Galactus, and it is a devourer of worlds, and it is all-consuming. And Storm even classifies her and says that, you know, when as she's feeling the psychic energy that's erupting off of Jean as the Phoenix, she says that there's just this all-consuming lust. And I think that we've really got to see that struggle here in this film, and she does a really good job of just someone that just wants answers and just really and what's happening,
right?
And I really enjoyed that. I thought that she did a really good job bringing us through this character's arc of being affected and then trying to come to terms and kind of come to peace with that. I thought that was a really unique way to take that character, where in the comics you have this person, not to compare it, because obviously this is an interpretation, but in the comics her character is really going throughout the course of that arc and just basically giving into that, and everyone around her giving
in. Now, it's been a long time since I've seen this, the Dark Phoenix arc, in at least animation form. If I remember correctly, there was a similar take on Jean Grey and the Dark Phoenix as we see here today, which is more the emotional take on the struggle, the emotional struggle. And I think, again, the animation was more that late 80s animation was more closer to the comic than, or as close as it can be, but it was the same type of Jean Grey, in a way, that it was an emotional Jean Grey. And with that struggle between her what she has to do and her family, so being the X-Men. So,
well, the comics, too, also had this like different kind of struggle for the character,
right,
where she wanted to give in to the darkness, but at this one is she's definitely torn between wanting to be with the family and one, or, you know, trying to find the answers. It's almost like she kind of can't have both,
right? So, but the reason, again, with my not really reading, I have to check my local library to see if they have the Dark Phoenix saga in trade form there, that way I could at least have a better reference in regards to that. And but that's I think mainly why I'm focusing on X3 as a baseline, because that's closer to recent memory for me than the animated series, or at least the original animated series. I don't know if X-Men Evolution covered it. I was a fan of that particular series when it came out, but I have to pull from more of a recent memory or a stronger memory for me. So those out there that want to fan rage, go ahead, fan rage. Feel free to correct me too, so I don't mind.
So this film is filled with visual effects, but it's also this line of films in First Class. Started with James McAvoy, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Hoult, and, of course, Michael Fassbender's Magneto. And this is the final film for them. Do you think that all of them were properly used to kind of have a send-off? Because we've been with these characters, keeping in mind, since 2011, so we're, 2 years away from... these characters and these versions of these characters for 8 years. Do you think that they gave them kind of the proper send off?
I don't think so, because to kind of compare it, the closest thing I could compare it to would be Endgame, which kind of gave everybody a proper send off. When you compare it to that, it was, if Endgame was maybe a 9, if not 10 on a 10 scale, this was maybe a 4. F that. Because you don't really have that send-off. Oh, having, you know, Cyclops put a new plaque outside and just walk in and it's like, oh, it's just another day in class.
Well, that also felt like really forced. Like, I didn't really like where they took a lot of these characters to kind of end it. Where, like, Magneto, I appreciated where we found him, and I liked why she went to him. Like, they gave him purpose. Like, that's what I, right. One of the things I walked in here with saying is, I really want to, Magneto has purpose in this film. And aside from one scene, I mean, he doesn't really add any really weird, really forced narrative choice to have him.
I can understand up to the point of going to see him and him coming out and having that Genosha reference. It was a good thing, if not good idea. Just that having him after that, you're right. Yeah,
thing where he's fighting the aliens. One of the best action sequences in the whole movie. Phenomenal. It was one of my favorite parts.
I was, what he did with the train car, yes. was awesome. I'll say that too. I was hoping you'd bring it up. It's like I wanted to focus more on Kurt than Magneto, but what he did was awesome. I was like, I want 80s cheese. After he kind of just pushed the crushed train car away, I was like, I want 80s cheese. I want 80s cheese. Please blow up. Please blow up. Please blow up. 2 minutes later, it finally blows up. I'm like, really? If it was real, I just wanted that 80s cheese. Like, it's like watching that classic 80s movie, see a car go off the cliff. It has to instantly blow up. But
then you didn't get that.
I didn't get that instant 80s cheese. But but if it did, you probably would have heard me in the theater go, yes. But I did enjoy his scenes, and he worked it very well. I will say what he did with the guns, even though I brought up the whole aspect of bullets, the whole bullets trope, but I know it seems hypocritical with me right now in regards to that, but he didn't know what was going on around him. So him having every gun pointed at her, at this particular bad person, was kind of an ingenious idea on his part. He didn't know. So best thing to do, I need more weapons. I don't have anything around. Oh, wait, there's guns here. Let me give this a try. And also, I could understand his thinking, I have to slow this person down for what's going on behind me.
I will say that is one of the, visually speaking, it's one of the best sequences in this movie. That and Magneto's in one of my other favorite scenes. I love the scene where Jessica Chastain's character, who never really gets a name, she's just kind of this mysterious lady in black.
Okay, let's say call her Emma Frost wannabe.
I'm just going to call her Chastain. But they're basically on top of this like stairwell, and Magneto enters into the room, and Magneto is levitated up towards her, and she just slowly starts to crush his head, like crush his helmet into his head and breaks, and just the angles that Kimberg was able to capture in
was a good scene. And it wasn't her that was doing it; it was
the Phoenix
that was doing it.
By that time, the Phoenix was in her.
Still in Jean Grey.
It wasn't Jean Grey.
Yeah. It didn't transfer until
it's like
Xavier got there.
Yeah, it's like right afterwards he had,
which was kind of almost as equally interesting scene. Walk to me, get up and walk, and she kind of puppet Matt kind of
destroys his chair too.
Yeah, crushes his chair. I almost had the image of Dream Warrior, Nightmare on Elm Street Dream Warrior, which is 3, of Krueger just puppet, you know, the one scene.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost like that, but it was just, that's the scene that kind of comes to mind now. It was almost
very creepy in the way that they did it. All right, so I think that for the majority of this, like, we've really dissected this. Again, just final thoughts.
See it at least once. I'm not going to say rent it. I'm going to say it's like at least see it in the theater once. If you can't, I'm not going to sit here and tell everybody go find Uncle Tony and find it, you know, get it through him. But if you want to see it in the theater, go see it in the theater. If you don't want to pay the $5-$10 for it, see if there's a theater near you that's does it at $2. See it at a $2 theater. My overall rating for it is maybe a.
Whoa! We haven't gotten a rating.
Okay.
Yet.
Okay.
No ratings.
Okay.
Yet.
Okay. I almost forgot. Josh is the leader in this dance. I do apologize for that. So.
I'm gonna go final go thoughts ahead. For me. I think that this could have been. All right. I'm not gonna say what it could have been. But this it's entertaining.
Yeah.
But misguided.
I could see that.
So, I'm going to let you... What would you give this on the Rorschach rating scale? 1 out of 5.
1 out of 5? 2.5.
Okay. I'm going to go with a 3. I feel like... There wasn't a need for Jessica Chastain villain. She's underdeveloped. She has no point or no real purpose to the plot. And even in that sequence where we didn't talk about this, but there's that sequence where she's explaining the origin of the Phoenix, but they never once say, call it by name. What's up with that?
The only time that they actually call it Phoenix is when it says, oh, you just rose up from the dead just like the Phoenix. And that was it. It was like a throwaway line.
Yeah. And I don't know. Some of the characters in here are a little bit, for the most part, like it's a visually stunning film. They're a little bit of CGI. Things really good. And Sophie Turner does a really good job as Jean Grey. Like you said, like it's.
I could go with that. I agree with you that. I'm gonna pretty much stand by the 2.5. If I go on my personal. Yeah, 10. It's going to be between at least a 6, 5.5, 6, because it's not going to go. It's going to be a very weak 6. Or if I go for a stronger 6, it's only because I'm here with you. Because I'm sharing this experience.
Don't let me sway your.
No. Folks who are fans of Victims and Villains know that sometimes I give 2 scores for. A movie on a 10 scale. One is what I think is the solid number for the movie, and there's another number where, like, okay, this movie is like a 7. The ambience, like I get my prime example is when I saw Hellraiser Bloodlines in theaters. I give the movie maybe a strong 6.5 out of 10. But because of the ambience that when I went to see it, it started as soon as I walked through the doors of the theater, thunderstorm, strong thunderstorm.
Nice.
And got my food and drink, and the theater I was playing in was the last theater on the right, and above the theater door was a flickering fluorescent bulb, kind of like giving a little bit more ambience, like you're going to see a horror flick in this particular theater. So, and when I got done with the movie, like, it never rained, never happened, light was not flickering, it was like, everything's okay now.
That's funny.
And it's like, that being said, I'm going to give it a strong 8 because of the ambience of going to see the movie.
The experience.
So, that's why I usually give two ratings sometimes. So.
Yeah, I think the experience of, like, being able to see it in theaters, I always loved seeing the X-Men in theaters. Like, the X-Men was really the first film franchise in the comic book genre that I really got into. I mean, I was super young when it came out, and being able to see Wolverine for, like, the first time was astonishing to me. So
I want
to
say, I know you said it on your end. Let me just say it here. I know it's close to the end of the show and all, but special thanks to the Alamo Draft House here in Winchester, who always gives a great experience seeing a film. So that probably would give, on my rating, add to that six. But
yeah, I love visiting the Alamo. It's a little bit of a drive for us out of studio, but it's awesome.
And right now, seeing what we are seeing right now, oh my God! I know I snapped two photos on Instagram. I'm sure as hell, after when you're getting cleaned up and putting everything away, I will be doing at least a little bit of a video for my YouTube channel and probably Facebook to show all of you out there what I am looking at right now, because words cannot describe. Well, they could probably do, but I just have no words for them right now.
Well, that's actually going to be a great segue. Where can people find you online?
Oh, they could find me, at least on Facebook. You can find me at facebook.com/TheLongCoatMafiaPodcast. To find our episodes online, you could find us at our main website, which is thelongcoatmafia.podbean.com. And that has all our episodes going back to our cringeworthy beginnings, and where we used one condenser USB microphone, and it was bad, but the content is there. We are, for right now, available on iTunes on your desktops. But if you're on the go and mobile, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and pretty much where podcasts are found.
All right. Well, you guys can also find us everywhere at Victims and Villains, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Apple Podcast, wherever you guys get your podcast from, Twitch, and more. And if you guys like what we stand for and want to help us get mental health resources into schools, conventions, and more, make sure that you guys consider supporting us on Patreon every month for as little as $2 a month. You guys can dictate the content that we create and also get access to exclusive awesome content that you can't get anywhere else. Or you guys can also pick up some awesome swag on our Etsy shop as well. All the money that we make off this show goes right back into getting mental health resources into those platforms. So special thanks to the Alamo Draft House once again for having us here in their wondrous projection room, where we are littered with films throughout the decades. It's so cool being here. But make sure that you guys tweet to us or leave a comment wherever you guys are listening to this, and let us know what you guys liked better, X-Men 3 or Dark Phoenix, or if you guys think that the comic still stands supreme. Make sure that you guys let us know what you guys thought of this movie wherever you guys get your podcast from. And until next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, speaking nothing else, and always stay out of the way of space debris.